Okay, everybody, thank you for joining Jim and I today. We're fortunate to have Rachel Bondy, who has been on our podcast one other time, back to join us and update us on what the good work she's doing. And she brought her famous friend John Hallman, who was at one time a big element of Apple and all the other media activities going along with George Lucas, et cetera. So it's going to be a fun conversation. And this once again, Rachel, please tell us how you came out of all of those media services that represent today's Meta AR VI world and ended up in the Navy like this.
So, hi, I'm Rachel Bondy, Technical Director for PMW 130, and I came out of industry as an anthropologist. So I said this on the last podcast. What I look at is people and process, and then the technology part is easy. It's to me, tech is as simple as, you know, chicken, fish, beef, tofu, pork, and in the Navy. You know, half the people are going to object to pork. Nobody wants the tofu and we can't afford beef. So what are we eating tonight is a pretty simple question to answer here compared to some jobs I've been on. I was brought in by the PM and the DPM, the previous folks, to shake up cyber and to try to figure out how we could match the pacing threat of the adversaries that we have by going a little bit faster. And my background in launching products and services to market was something they thought I could apply here. And I have. Our teams have done a lot of really good work. I'll be hitting my 3-year anniversary in December. Pearl Harbor Day is my anniversary, so it's easy to remember. And I'm excited to share what's happened since our first conversation, where I was very green, but actually was a very good conversation. I just listened to it again this week, and we talked about a lot of things that are still very relevant today. So I hope that we can kind of revisit and then add to that story.
Perfect. Thank you, Rachel. And thanks to Rachel, we have John Hallman with us, who has also never been with the government before the last few months because Rachel brought him in to build up her team. So John, tell us a little bit about your famous background and how you're doing with Rachel on your new venture.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on. Thank you, Rachel, for inviting me to speak to the team. And I come out of industry, as Rachel did. I spent 25 plus years in Silicon Valley working for many named tech companies like Motorola and Apple and Lucasfilm. I left in about 2014 to pursue helping startup companies. And that's been fantastic, working with 300 to 400 different companies in building their narrative, first customer acquisition, all the things that startup companies go through. And so when Rachel approached me and said, hey, why don't you bring that skill set to the Navy? That almost sounds like an oxymoron. Can we help startups who are bringing great technology to the Navy and get them in the hands of the warfighter? So I've been on board now for about 6 months. I think I am really starting to get my arms around the acronym-laden world of the Navy, which is a very challenging thing. I'm seeing the rice bowls. I'm hearing about all the silos that exist. And yet I'm seeing within 130 a real desire to move things forward faster, fail faster, bring great technologies, as Rachel put, to match the pacing threat. So I'm really honored to be a part of the team and look forward to this conversation.
That's excellent. I love your phrase, fail faster, which is what Jim and I have been trying to get the Navy to do for a long time. Unfortunately, we tend to fail and then hold it. We can talk more about that. So, Rachel, why don't you update us on where you have gotten with all of your Spinnaker implementation and your data as a service and all the good work that's going on?
Sure. So the last time we talked, it was about the pilot that we were putting together to connect our data all the way up to U.S. Cyber Command and back. And at that time, the PM had asked me, well, you know, how fast do you think you could put together a joint data fabric? And I said, well, it's you swipe the credit card and then you stand up the instance in the cloud and then it should take about 4 weeks. And he laughed. He goes, it's going to take longer than that. And I said, okay, how about 8 weeks? We'll double it. And he said, well, I'll take that bet. Let's see what you do. So I was able to assemble a team of five, and we did the pilot in 8 weeks for, it was just over 100K, and demonstrated at the time that we could send data back and forth with BDP. Now BDP, the big data platform, is now called Unified Platform. It was DISA's stack of open source software that allows all of the services to work together in what's called the JICWA framework, so the Joint Cyber Warfare Architecture. And we were mandated by Congress in 2020. It was said that all services should use BDP. Navy didn't join. And so 2021 specified that Navy needed to use BDP. So what we launched was Spinnaker BDP. And unlike the other services, we did host it in AWS, but it is a multi-cloud solution. So our BDP works with their BDPs. And we were able to, in the subsequent 6 months since the call, stand up what we called Spinnaker U, which is the unclassed version. And the unclassed version, what we demonstrated was, I still had Inox at the time as far as C4I was concerned. And so my idea was to get Inox, which is the integration of 10.10 and 10.20. So the integration of cyber operations and security operations was something that was in PowerPoints since a UN in 2016, I think it was. And I said, well, we got to get this out of PowerPoint. So let's make this Spinnaker the methodology by which we demonstrate to everybody how much you can get done with two teams of five, two pizza teams, one side understanding the cloud environment and one side understanding the BDP, and put it together like a Reese's cup where we have the chocolate and peanut butter into a tasty dish that can be served to all involved. And that at the same time, we would show how to do that with Agile. So that's what we did. In the next 6 months, we delivered over 30 new capabilities to NCDOC, NavalNet WarCom, Naval Postgraduate School. We were able to stand up in a couple of weeks a demo environment for them to do red team and blue team activities when previously it had taken 9 months for them to set something up. We were able to demonstrate Sabre data, which is the OT systems, for the first time as a visualization. There were multiple use cases, including MLAI with the DevRon team and in Fleet Cyber Command. So not going into the details, every 10 days or so, we delivered a new capability. We did what is called an inspect and adjust meeting with the stakeholders. And we showed what true DevSecOps looked like with the actual developers, the operators, and the security piece woven in to a process where every 10 days they'd inspect, adjust, accept that we had delivered what it is they asked for as a capability, and then we would move on and to the next capability. And we went through delivering unclassed versions of MCSA, so the Maritime Cyber Situational Awareness requirements, until finally in the course of 6 months, we finished demonstrating what that looked like. And as a result, the INOX piece went to PEO Digital, and they are now standing up what is a safe Agile framework, so scaled Agile for all of the Navy, the DOD and N, to be able to continue to deploy underneath a data fabric EPIC every week, new capabilities for those same cyber situational requirements. And we also were able to demonstrate that ability of that zero trust, modernized, digitized, all of the buzzword data centric environments that were already integrated and already automated through the cloud services of Flank Speed. And that's something that Don CIO is carrying forward in the Zero Trust implementation plan. And PEO Digital is running with and has done a lot of press, a lot of discussions about their plan to extend that out to the Godin environment. And then it recently got approved for IL-6. So now we're revisiting everything and launching Spinnaker S, the secret version of the BDP out of 130, and assisting with experiments as we go forward for the entire Navy, supporting Naval Net Warcom and NCDOC as they extend to what they're calling the SOC of the future, the Security Operations Center, under this new Zero Trust paradigm. So I've said a lot there, but a lot has gone on.
You always say a lot, Rachel. So let me, I want to go back to the Ruth Youngsloo interaction that you've had in a little while, but let's let John explain to us a little bit about what he's been doing. And in the process, I'm going to go offline because I've got a lot of noisy dogs and things going on around here. So I'll go upstairs and come back online from upstairs. Go ahead, John.
Going up. I don't know whose thumb it is. So just for the context of John, so, you know, once we had a cloud environment, it became much more realistic to think about having new applications roll in. And so that's why I brought him in to understand how we could expedite the entire environment of cloud hosted mission applications in that secured Zero Trust platform as a service. So go ahead, John.
Well, thank you for that. I think anybody who takes on the challenge of going from industry to working with the DoD or working with the Navy in particular here, you start asking some very top level questions. And the topics of transition and valley of death become these overarching things where you introduce yourself that, hey, I'm here to start working on improving technology transition or solving the valley of death. You in some cases get an eye roll. You'll get people who say, wow, that's big. But more often than not, they want to introduce you to, you know, 13 or 14 other groups, people, organizations throughout the DoD that have all tried to tackle this. And so when first talking with Rachel about, you know, bringing some of the industry skill set of helping entrepreneurial innovators bring their technology better, faster, cheaper to their client, in this case, the warfighter, I knew that I had a lot of work to do in just understanding what ground had been trodden already in looking at this. Now, it's great to have a framework, you know, a cloud framework to say we're developing this platform architecture to bring forward these technologies. We still have a lot of challenges as it relates to how things have been done in the past and how things can be done better, faster, cheaper, if you will. So in the last 6 months, it's really just been getting a lay of the land, understanding what's worked and what hasn't worked. And I think that, you know, for the sake of this conversation, the one takeaway is there is no shortage of individuals, teams, from PMWs up through PEOs, through the other services, of folks who want to solve this problem. I think there's a great understanding of the pacing threat out there, and that we need to move, you know, better, faster, less expensive. I'm not going to say cheaper, but better, faster, less expensive. We need to innovate at all levels, but we also need to incentivize our people to do things in a different way. We have to think differently. And sorry to go back to that, you know, early days at Apple where we thought different, but we need to think differently about how we do this. So I think our work right now is starting, you know, with you know, the entrepreneurs and new companies who want to bring these solutions. How do we lend an ear? How do we listen? How do we help them find investment through the vehicles that already exist, the SIBRs and the SITRs of the world, but then carry that forward? Once somebody is funded, how do they stay funded? How do we then move it into sustainment? So there's a lot of challenges there. But I think the vision that's been extended by the CTO's office out of Navarre and out of NIWC PAC through Rachel's work is really being established, and looking forward to continue to contribute. I'm arguably at the infancy. And so next time we meet, I hope to have some really good transition stories and some war stories that start getting everybody's head nodding in the right direction, that the DoD and the military is not stuck in a quagmire, and that real true innovation is happening. And we are listening to the needs of the warfighters and of the industry and of the government, and matching and exceeding and excelling in bringing that transition forward.
And just a note on your comment about Apple. So when we started what's now Nav War, I was on the team that helped start that command, the new command, and we created what has become the 5.0 shop that you work with. And when we started that shop, we all, because I was an Apple fan, we started the whole organization with those old original Apple toaster box computers, and we're running the organization of about, I don't know, we had 3 admirals and 3 SESs and about 80 people running on all on Apples. So Jim, let me ask you what you might want to throw into this.
I'll just say that I had to go out and get a Mac because the delivery to Spaywar was an Apple formatted document. So we got approval when I was at Goodyear to buy a Mac for John Wiseman, and I bought Mac SEs for $3,400.
Yeah, that's
what the one thing that I'll share from my Apple days that trust me was a very long time ago, but I think it's very pertinent to today's conversation, which is this notion of failing faster. I think one of the things that Steve Jobs instilled at Apple and carries on today is experimentation and failure are part of business, and they're actually coveted. It felt, and sorry, Rachel, that I may throw Microsoft under the bus a little bit here, but it felt in those days that when Apple had something that maybe didn't go to what they wanted it to, and I put the Mac Cube out there as an example of a product that maybe didn't succeed to the degree that they wanted to. Steve instilled within the people that work there and within the greater community that's okay. That experimenting and trying something new and different and failing and learning is really what you want, versus say maybe how we would look at the Microsoft Zoom product and just call it a failure and throw it out. So I'm really thrilled by the fact that there is this ongoing conversation about failing faster and taking those key learnings and moving forward. So that's what we're doing. And like I said, in 6 months or so, I hope to come back to you with some transition stories and some really great work that the 130 team and the NIWC PAC team are doing to bring some great things forward.
Yeah, hey, Zoom was the same team as the iPod there, because they all left Apple and came over to my side.
Fair enough.
And by the way, Matt, so he's all Steve Jobs. I'm Bill Gates. But if you remember at the time when Microsoft was going through the monopoly issue, Bill showed up on the big screen behind Steve to fund everything that is now the iPhone. So, and our teams in Silicon Valley were the ones that were creating the biggest application used on the Mac, which was Office. So it's all part of the same family. A lot of times, but this stuff is very co-opetition.
But I think we have to give the Fail Fast Often Award today to Elon Musk so we can all be interspatial civilizations, right? Did you have another question, Jim?
Yeah, I maybe a year ago, Marv and I did a podcast with Bill Greenwald, who worked for Senator McCain. It was kind of responsible to get OTAs back into the DoD, from the NASA days of the late 50s. There's been some comments within our Navy space that we're like the last service to really take advantage of OTAs, where like Army is doing $500-600 million and Space Force is doing $1 billion OTAs. Is there any plans to use OTAs that are fairly sizable to do some fail fast projects? Or are you still using the typical cost plus fixed fee contract?
So that's an acquisition question. And we have the first software acquisition program. So that's what NCSA is. And that's meant to expedite being able to deploy the solution. I don't have any OTAs going right now, but I'm not opposed to the idea. So one of the things I pre-hiring John Hallman, I was thinking that it would be very helpful to understand the context that he had about funding vehicles as far as startups, as far as being able to launch and use usable technologies, right? And at the time, my thought was, well, he'll be able to come up with an analogy like angel funding versus venture capital versus crowdsourced funding, et cetera, to be able to move us forward, because it's really all about here. I say Mr. PBIS, the PPBES and the actual PBIS system and where the money's coming from. But my epiphany was that in reality, we have only one funding source, and that's Congress. It's how Congress has divided the money into this very complicated board game where we all have to figure out where the money went and who has it to be able to align that with the actual technologies. And what you get is this outcome that is so complicated that you can't actually say, I need to have this technology to the warfighter. I'm going to get it from this lab, this university, or this other COT solution, and I can actually pull it in and then I can transition it to my program. My epiphany is that there needs to be some sort of clarity in the alignment with the programs themselves. If that's where you're successfully transitioning to, then our programs of record should actually have some piece that funds the new. Because as it exists today, programs of record are not incentivized to do new. They're not incentivized to, they're incentivized to do cost, performance, and schedule. And if that's all that you are incentivized by, that's what you're going to do. And so it's almost as if our acquisition programs are on a Navy concept of last orders. It's as if they got some last order back in 2016 to move out on cyber, and that they're going through these wickets to continue to move out whatever that was. Canes looks the same to me that way, right? And nothing's going to break up what they're doing on that cost, performance, and schedule. So if something new happens, if something disruptive happens, if there's some new mandate like zero trust, the reaction of the existing programs is to just wince, brace themselves, and make an excuse not to do it. Because their incentive on cost would be, even if you accelerate it, even if you make it cheaper, they don't want that. They want to spend the money that they have. It's the game is to spend the money that you have and to spend it in the correct increments that say that you're meeting the cost, performance, and schedule measurements. And the performers that you've hired to perform, if they aren't of the skill set of the new technology, that causes another problem of who I hire and how I re-engage. So I'm really looking at it differently than I did 3 years ago because of the work that we're starting to look at and the nice funding that we got from NIWC PAC to fund this hack of the Valley of Death.
I got to congratulate you, Rachel. You learned in 3 years what I had learned over the last 50, which is a big part of the problem is Congress, because we divide up the money so much. Everybody that has money in a program, they're not incentivized to spend the money in cooperation with anybody else, because they want to look better on their own. And it's the reason why we've always had a different network for every different program, a different compute infrastructure for every program. For example, Canes was designed to be the one and only infrastructure on every ship. Right now, the newest ship being built, the new frigate, is going to have seven compute network infrastructures, because they're from all the different syscoms. In fact, when I used to work for Wayne Meyer, he always said, if you want to see what the ship's going to look like, you just have to look at the organization, because that the organization is going to put the stuff on the ship. And that's the way it continues to run.
So tell me what you think of this, because I had the opportunity to go out with the Trident Warrior team and test CPCON, which is in essence cyber protective controls that are similar to MCON, so emissions control. But what you're doing is you're going through different levels and you're shutting down systems if they've been compromised. But I was out there for 2 weeks. And one of the things I realized is that we really overcomplicate deploying IT systems because there's really three people on the ship who care. It's the CSO, the CISO, and maybe the N6 who's coming on board with the strike group care about IT systems at all. So it'd be very easy to have a user conversation about what users desire and what they need to have afloat. It's not that, it's not as complicated as people made it out to be for me. But also that when you're out on the ship, that the ship is compartmentalized. So it's almost like I don't want to say high school, but there is a yearbook that comes from the ship, so maybe it is like high school. But you have the divisions literally physically within the ship for where you can walk and who you can talk to and what you can do. And originally, I thought, well, this is, you know, the Navy's done security through obfuscation, right? I can't find out from a single source the things that I would in industry. Like in industry, if I walked in and I went to audit, they would know all the systems and they'd give me a list of systems or assets. If I went to legal, they'd have all the contracts in one place. If I didn't find what I wanted from those folks, there would be another group like HR would have the list of assets associated with individuals or things. There were centralized places, but here it was all separated. I thought, oh, that's by design, but it's not. It's kind of like the ship and the shore are a reflection of these natural divisions of people and process that are part of the order of Navy. And the one way that you can get around that is to find the person or the individual that has enough power over the top to make a decision about changing the systems that are used for all of those individuals in those different silos or rice bowls. And for cyber, that doesn't exist today. I had this conversation with Chris Cleary, the PCA, where he was saying, you know, you can kind of bucket cyber into systems you need to secure around zero trust, and those are enterprise. And then there's survivability on the ship. So those are weapon systems and navigation and OT things. And then there's strike, which is OCO and red team activities. And within 130, we address the first two, but not the other one. And within INOX, they were identifying the problem was between the cyber and the security operations being two separate things. But I find it to be culturally, just a reflection of how things have functioned historically within the Navy. What do you think of that lesson learned out at sea when I went underway?
No, it's a great lesson, great explanation of it also. So thank you for that. You reminded me while you were talking, the German sociologist Max Weber was the inventor of the term bureaucracy. And he always said the only way you can win out of a bureaucracy is you have to find a charismatic leader that rises up and breaks all the rules, and the people will realize that that's good and follow that person instead of sticking with the bureaucracy. But in a bureaucracy, it's always easy, no matter whatever level you're on, to say no to a good idea, not yes, because if you say yes, you're sticking your neck out. So that's why Max said you got to find the charismatic leaders that are willing to stick their neck out and then follow them. And if you look at our Navy career, that's what Hyman Rickover was. That's what Wayne Meyer was. That's what all of our great leaders that stuck around long enough to make a big difference. You're too young to realize it, but in 1986, the DoD passed the Goldwater-Nichols Defense Authorization Act. during that act, which created the COCOMs, it also created all acquisition decisions to be approved by the secretariat side. So the Navy RDA and the DoD AT&L were created by Goldwater-Nichols. What happened before Goldwater-Nichols is the services ran all the organizational decisions and the secretariat oversaw it. They just would take a view of it. And if they had a big problem with it, they'd call a halt or call a meeting, but they didn't make every decision. So what happened is we bureaucratized the system radically after 1986. And I say, by looking back at the Navy, if you look at everything we have in the Navy today, most of what makes the Navy great was created before 1986, because all the Aegis ships, including the destroyer, were designed and created before 1986. And then after 86, what have we got? We've got a 35-year F-35 program, right? You can go down the list. You find all of that because we have more bureaucracy. So thankfully, you're breaking down some of those bureaucratic rules. You're one of the charismatic leaders we need, and we need more of that. And there is a lot of things that have happened well, good, like Jim just mentioned. The creation of other transaction authority is the biggest, most important change that's happened in my career in the DoD. And that's because we now have the ability to light off within months, fail fast, and do it on small amounts of money, because you don't have to, because what they do if they have to let a contract that's going to be a long contract is they keep piling on all the requirements onto the contract. Makes it hard to write the contract, hard to award the contract, hard to disrupt the contract, hard to deploy or succeed on the contract. And I'm such a fan of OTAs. I think everything in DoD should be prototype to production. That's how we ought to do everything, is prototype to production. But we're as Jim said, we're not doing it fast enough in the Navy, but we are starting to move down that path.
Yeah, to kind of complement John's comments, I mean, just like you have rounds of financing from the VC side, you could have OTAs, and if they don't work, you just can it and you move on, you know, and you might fund four or five OTAs in four or five different companies. Cause as you know, there's lots of good ideas out there, but I'd much rather get 200K and know in 6 months whether you're going to fund me again, as opposed to, well, you funded me last year, just keep funding me. Right. And then over time, I just assume you're going to keep funding me. And then 20 years later, I'm still getting funded every year, not really delivering anything.
Yeah. And to add to that, there are funding vehicles, but in some cases, the rank and file don't know they exist, or they don't know how to access it, and they don't know how to transition. And when we think about our technical resources, we want them to be building technology, not processing forms or administering paperwork. So one of the steps we're taking, it's a project that I'm working on, you know, that Rachel put together as part of my coming on board, is really help specifically, and we wanted to get laser focused on working with NIWC PAC engineers and scientists on how do we take their ideas to the nth degree as far as they can go. And part of that is just helping them understand the journey as it relates to funding. Where do I get my money and how do I do it? Versus finding out that a proposal is due next week because an email went out, but really helping them with interactive tools that guide them through this process, allow them to plan for their development and inventive process, and strip away some of that administrative side, get them queued up to move forward. And then when it becomes evident that maybe a technology has run its course, to then move on to the next thing, or to take that and maybe work with a different group to transition it to something where it's additive, where that 1+1=3 formula is really part of the process. But right now we're seeing, you know, scientists saying, I'm not doing science. I'm doing paperwork. And we need to really address that. And that's part of some of the laser focused work we're doing in bringing those tools to bear, because there are funding sources. They're not always understood to the, you know, to the greatest degree. And it goes back to that thing that I brought up at the very beginning. It's about the narrative. How do we tell the story better? How do we make people more effective in the jobs we're asking them to do, while in the background looking at some of those grander changes that are necessary to, you know, continue pacing with the adversary?
To your points, I really like what you're talking about. I just recently learned through Mark Evans, one of our partners, I think Rachel knows, that in the DoD at the top, where the CDAO office is, the Chief Data AI office, they have stood up a website called tradewindsai.com. And if you know about that, you know that they now are doing things like allowing people to send in monthly 5-minute videos of what they can do to help solve different problems. And they can award in as fast as 2 weeks monies to those 5-minute videos to help move experimentation forward to support the RFI and the RFPs that they're going to let out of that office. So that is another example of where we got people that are changing the course of the bureaucratic world we live in. So let me ask you guys, we're getting probably way past our time. I'm not watching the time very well. How do you see us continuing this zero trust to the edge and moving cybersecurity out of this RMF bureaucracy that's been holding back the movement of new capabilities out there, whether it's through using digital twins or using continuous red teaming or pen testing? We are not doing enough to make cybersecurity effective and efficient, as best I can tell.
Yeah, the most important piece of that to me is, let me turn this off here, is the narrative of zero trust. And the story that zero trust has to say is that perimeter security, so network access driven solutions, throwing a tap, throwing out some sort of a sensor between the firewall switch and server on a network to be able to defend in a moat, castle moat style, is now antiquated. And the expectation is that you can't trust that the network is secure. And so what's the option? Well, the option is to move from network access to identity access and secure the application, secure the data itself, so that independent of the network, you're securing the actual environment. And so what you need for that is you still need transport. You know, you still need dial tone. You still need bars on your phone. You still need, you know, your Starbucks Wi-Fi. The equivalent of that on a ship is that there are many networks available. But the most important thing is to secure whatever the information is that the joint or the coalition partners need to fight a war. And so if you have that bandwidth available and you have that information secure, now you have the ability to fight the war together. And that's what Zero Trust is attempting to accomplish, is look at that piece of information, make sure that it is secure, and then be able to get it to the person who has the right to see it through the privileged access management that is identity driven. So how do you move our environment? Well, we're missing a lot of things. We're missing policy decision points, zero trust. We're missing policy enforcement points. We haven't really looked at secure access service edge, which is a software defined boundary. We have the robotic process automation piece of that. We have the remote procedure calls that are part of that architecture. So there are a lot of things within a zero trust architecture that need to be considered. And also it affects the RMF process. So part of zero trust is the continuous monitoring of the environment and understanding the status of the assets at any time, rather than submitting a static thing for EMAS, understanding how things evolve, what's the baseline, and being able to see in live motion and be able to respond to that in an automated fashion. So that's one of the exciting things about the zero trust solution that we deployed, is we did it as a subscription service ashore first, and then we've done a successful experiment afloat. So I can't go into a great deal about it, but I was told that, you know, we couldn't do something afloat, it wouldn't work. And I didn't see why it wouldn't. The PLEO solutions that we have, the biggest gating factor was bandwidth availability to modernization, and that gave us bandwidth. But if we're more focused on identity and the data centricity and securing that data, we could host that in a secure cloud. So a hyper-converged infrastructure, or HCI. And so looking at that solution, running that afloat as a zero trust enclave, is something that we're moving forward with as a Navy. And again, I see it as an expansion of the portfolio capabilities. I see it as a mandate to deliver that zero trust environment on or before 2027. And with the Pacific pivot, it even becomes more vital to make those solutions available for the joint forces, for unmanned, and for the afloat environments to have a similar set of capabilities that you have ashore. So it's very cutting edge. And I'm excited to say that the team is, you know, extending our solutions to the edge, and it's meaningful to the operators and the sailors that they can have teams that can do their security operations in those environments as well, and work with the teams, the CSSP ashore.
Very good. And one of the things that, back to our bureaucratic world, I love the fact that we got a presidential executive order to put in zero trust, and most of the program offices say, well, I don't have a requirement for zero trust. They don't consider the president's right. EO a requirement.
What they do have is a requirement to secure their environment.
They do.
And so how they decide to secure the environment is they can either make an excuse and say, I can't do it, I don't have a requirement for zero trust, or they can take a look at existing funded requirements and say, it's a derived requirement that I achieve that through the DoD's COA 2, which is public cloud. And that I go ahead and take a look at what cloud solutions are available to give me that integration, that seamlessness, that zero trust, that modernized, digitized environment that is the aim or the goal of being able to compete effectively with our adversaries. And this is something that I think is probably the most important point of this call, is it's not really about zero trust, but it's that the zero trust maturity model delivers cyber as a warfighting capability. And I think that that's something that we really need to take a look at as, you know, what does that mean? So if we have information warfare and we have electronic warfare, where does cyber warfare fit in there? What kinds of manuals and what kinds of collateral need to be created? What sort of courses need to be created by Naval Postgraduate or the Warfare College? You know, what does that mean to the actual information warfare commander? What's his authority? You know, when he says something needs to occur, who's responsive to that? What does he own? Especially within a combat situation. And I don't think that there's enough definition right now. You know, the context is still that you're working in IT systems. Well, IT systems are a cost center, so you want the lowest cost solution. That's not the solution for cyber warfighting. Cyber warfighting is all about investment. And we need to invest in that warfighting capability when we define what it is and make some decisions about what that means to the actual cyber operators, the CYBO, the rates associated with it, and formalizing that much as we did in the past with Navy nukes. But again, Navy nukes is something that was an individual person who decided to stand up and say, we need this, and then put everything behind it. And I don't see that happening yet. Yet.
So there you go, Rachel. You're exhibiting your charismatic leadership and thought processes again, because the bureaucratic thought process, well, they just say wait until they get a requirement for zero trust, even though we know that they have a requirement for security. But to carry your point forward, when I worked for Admiral Meyer back in the 80s and 90s, one of the things that he did to make the Aegis so successful, and by the way, he never missed a milestone, and he never missed cost, performance, and schedule, but he would have a spring spectacular. And a spring spectacular was to show in a video, a short video, something that he could take to all the halls of Congress and explain to them why he had just succeeded at making a missile do something, or a radar do something, or something do something that was going to solve the problem of taking out all of the air defense issues that they had. And then his program would get plussed up, and so he had never missed. He'd never miss the cost, performance, and schedule because he could carry it forward. So that's charismatic leadership. That's what we need to put in place. And that's what's got to move forward in this world. And you're exactly right. The future war is cyber war, whether it's faking out their AI or your AI, or using your electronic means, or coordinating it with the hard kill weapons. But there is not, we all know there's not nearly enough hard kill weapons to satisfy the challenges that are going to happen in the Pacific or pick another place on the planet. So, John, can I let you add to this as we start to wrap this up?
You know, I think it was well said is probably the best thing for me to say now. Rachel and I have gone back and forth many times on these topics, and there was a lot of ground covered here. And I'm looking forward to going back and listening to what was talked about here and then putting it into action plans, but really bringing them down to the innovators and to the entrepreneurs who want to do business with today's Navy and helping them and do so, but really helping our scientists as well bring great technologies and get them in the hands of the warfighter.
And I'm glad to hear that you're doing that, John, and doing it both at the Warfare Center team level as well as to the leadership team level, because there's always great people out there across the system, and there's always people that want to make change and work fast. You just have to help make it easy for them to do that. And let me let Jim for any additional points that he may want to offer.
Yeah, just keep pushing the envelope. I applaud what you guys are doing, because I think there's just a lot of great opportunity, and I'm more optimistic that with all this collaboration going on, you'll be able to change some things. Just like it took a few years for companies to get CISOs, right? We need a cyber warfare office on board a ship.
Yeah. I really look at it as, you know, again, Margaret Mead, right? You know, if you think a small group can't make a change, actually, that's the only way it ever has happened. And I very much appreciate the people who have been here 10 years, 20 years, 30 years in helping me avoid mistakes because of how much knowledge that they lend to this. And, you know, I really like developing our existing bench of people. A lot of my team members have already been promoted or moved to larger projects. Several of them have gone to digital, so that's kind of unexpected. Again, looking at what the outcome is more important than looking at the tribe necessarily. So if a solution is going to go out to a warfighter faster through Don CIO, PEO Digital, through MLB, through another group, we're all Navy. And it may not be that the best transition path is to a program, although we have transitioned, you know, Red Seal and the Spinnaker technologies and Azure and so on to the existing programs of record. That may not be the path. You know, John was working on something with graphene out in Hawaii, and it looks like the Air Force might use that. So again, the most important thing is saying that we're on the same team and that we're getting these technologies that were stuck, unstuck, and getting them as quickly as possible into the hands of the warfighter, and because they're the ones who need it. And, you know, again, you know, talking with the sailors out on the ship was one of the more exciting things in my career. You talk about Hollywood. Well, I'd been around Tom Cruise playing Maverick. I'd much rather be with the guys who are actually out there fighting the war than trying to get a solution for Tom.
Including those guys that were flying Maverick in the front seat.
Yeah, Hollywood is Hollywood, but this is real, and it's
exactly
much,
right.
More significant mission to our families and to the nation. So I just consider it a nice compliment to be able to be part of this team.
All right. Well, let me thank you again, and we'll wrap it up today. But it sounds to me like we probably ought to come back and talk about this again in a few months and see if we can make some more progress. Thank you both. It's been an excellent discussion.